stressful at times. Then we're going to be going through Roberto Toro, who will be discussing some new findings in anatomy. And I'll go last and say, how do we build on those findings in anatomy to translate some of those things into potential new treatments? Okay, so that's the kind of structure of how we're going to go today. And so we'll start with anatomy. And welcome to anatomy.
Great. I'm going to waste no time, having only 20 minutes, and I've set myself the task of taking you from synapse to cognition, behavior, and therapy in those 20 minutes. So some of this we're going to really fly through. My fundamental interest is in what makes the difference between people in individual families affected by autism and people unaffected by autism. And back in 2004, in a couple of papers, we published a model in which autism perhaps begins with local network abnormalities, which then interact with normal programs and gradients of activity-dependent brain development to produce the emergent symptoms of autism. What we think is going on, and what has received some support from findings in the past 8 years on a number of levels, is that within local networks, perturbations of neural connectivity sabotage what we call network entropy. Now, what do I mean by that? Some of you who know information theory are already familiar with the concept of Shannon entropy, but for the rest of you, I'll just give you the intuitive sense. Representing information in a brain is rather like representing information on a blackboard or a whiteboard. It depends upon having contrast between activated units, or darkened areas of the board, and inactivated units, or lightened areas. So when you have over-connectivity at a local level and hyper-propagation of neural signal, it's rather like trying to write on a whiteboard with a marker that is runny. So you cannot actually create discernible traces of information. Likewise, if you have local underconnectivity, you end up with the same problem, a deficit in local network entropy, because you are unable to activate local parts of the network. So whether your network is overconnected or underconnected on a local level, you end up in either case with the same fundamental deficit in local network entropy. Now, in this instance, I've illustrated a situation in which you have local overconnectivity. In a case like that, actually local overconnectivity or a local underconnectivity, in the case of overconnectivity, your neurons are propagating so much noise that the signal, the information of interest, is lost in that noise. In the case of underconnectivity, your neurons are propagating so little signal that, again, the signal to noise is rubbish. So it requires this balance between not too much of underconnectivity, not too much of overconnectivity. This is what Eric was talking about in the before the break, about the balance between excitation and inhibition. If the signal is discernible from the noise, then you get these secondary activity-dependent connections, specific connections, between brain areas whose activities are correlated. And as brain and cognition mature over the first few years of life, you end up with a brain in which widely separated anatomical subregions end up flexibly connecting with each other in order to solve novel problems. Well, in a brain in which local connectivity and therefore local information capacity has been sabotaged, you end up not developing that specific pattern of useful long-range connections. Instead, connections that should be there aren't, and connections that should not be there are there. So what you end up with is a brain that operates more as a collection of autonomous sub-processors rather than a top-down controlled network of brain regions and cognitive processes under the control of one central executive. Hence the typical autistic description of thinking at a very iconic level of raw processing instead of an elaborated, abstracted, symbolic level. What sort of mind do you develop if you have a brain that is disconnected at a long-range level like this, in which each of the separate bits of brain are operating more or less autonomously? Well, of course, we all develop to make the best use of the brains that we have. That's true whether we're autistic or non-autistic. And if you have a disconnected autistic brain, you tend to develop a cognitive strategy that specializes in one single perceptual channel without integrating separate sensory modalities. You would tend to develop a brain that specializes in detail rather than integrated and contextualized information. You would tend to develop a brain that specializes in iconic rather than abstract symbolic reference. And you would tend to develop a brain that sees both the social and non-social worlds egocentrically rather than elaborated and allocentrically. So the social and non-social symptoms of autism, from the point of view of connectivity theory, begin to seem of a piece. Just to say, I won't go into the details of this slide because I don't have much time, but we can actually measure physiological variables using in the context of a non-social experiment. This happens to be a simple go-no-go task. And we can relate these. This is P3 amplitude in a no-go condition. We can relate these to social variables. This is the individual score on Simon Baron Cohen's Reading the Mind in the Eyes test. So social and non-social processing go together. Parce que nous sommes en France, il faut que je traite un peu de philosophie. I think the French philosopher Jacques Lacan made a very pithy observation relative to human cognition in general, and specifically relative to autistic cognition, when he wrote, "Le symbole se manifeste d'abord comme l'œuvre de la chose." The symbol manifests firstly as the killing of the thing. Now, what does he mean by that? I cannot really say it any better than a person with autism who wrote in 1994 on the St. John's University autism mailing list. He said, "It's just that putting myself in someone else's shoes means that I first have to force that person out of their own shoes." Now, he was aware of the metaphor here, right? I mean, that's not the issue. The difficulty here is one of maintaining two separate and conflicting representations simultaneously. The world as it is to me, the world as it is veridically, and the world as it might be if I were to take a different spatial, temporal, or social perspective. So we're interested in this notion of exercising cognitive capacities that make use of integrated processing. And we want to do that in a way that relates social and non-social processing. So here's one experiment that I want to tell you about. This is as non-social as you can get, okay? It's a two alternative force choice. You have to press the yes button if the stimulus on the left is orientated this way, which it is not in this picture. And simultaneously, the stimulus on the right is orange. So you have to combine color, orientation, and spatial location. That is a highly integrated perceptual problem. Now, we can make that problem harder by introducing spatially intervening distractors, or we can make it easier by making those distractors congruent so that you can collapse information across spatial locations and so that you perceive only one color and one orientation at a time. So if we compare the hard condition to the easy condition? Well, this is a slide with very much a lot of information, but I just want to focus your attention on a couple of panels. First of all, look at this panel. I deliberately left these traces unlabeled. What you're looking at here is an autistic group, a non-autistic group without any autism spectrum condition in the family, and a group of non-autistic siblings of people with autism. Now, we present these stimuli very briefly so that there's no time for a staccato, but then we need a 3-second decision interval. And also, it takes about 3 seconds for the hemodynamic response to peak. So in a brain area that's related to the performance of this task, you should see a peak with a delay of 6 seconds from stimulus onset. Now, each one of these little marks is 2 seconds, right? So 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, so on and so forth. So we're going to have a little quiz for audience involvement. You tell me which of these traces, red, blue, or pink, are the typical individuals without any autism in the family. Now you have to vote, okay, even if you guess it. So, how many people say blue? And how many people say red? And how many people say pink? Okay, so it's just, I think the pink wins it by just an edge. Well, I had expected more from scientists, actually. Think about it, dudes. 6-second latency, right? 2, 4, 6, there's our peak in the red trace. That is the typical individuals. Now, the interesting bit happens when you decide which of the two remaining traces are the autistic individuals. So how many people think that the blue are the autistic individuals? And how many people think that the pink are the autistic individuals? Interesting. Okay, so the pink wins it. Okay, so well, unfortunately, the majority are wrong again. The blue actually are the autistic individuals. The pink are the non-autistic siblings. So what is going on here? Well, both the groups, the autistic group and the non-autistic sibling group, have a similarly delayed time course of differential prefrontal cortical activation in response to this difficult attentional and perceptual task. The difference is that the people without autism, they're late in pressing the accelerator, as it were, but once they do press it, they put it down to the floor. The people with autism do not have so much differentiated activation. So it turns out that the latency of this activation peak across individuals correlates very well with ADIR in the case of the people with autism and autism spectrum quotient in the case of the siblings, measures of social communicative traits of autism. It does not correlate with the repetitive behaviors measure. But this is a purely non-social experimental paradigm, which now we are correlating against social communicative traits of autism. Okay, so it seems what we have here is a trait localized to frontal lobe that runs in families in which some people in these families are resilient to having that trait snowball during development into emergent traits of autism, and some people are not as resilient. So this is a trait then that links autistic and non-autistic individuals within the same families. We can ask them what actually differentiates the autistic from the non-autistic individuals. And here's what we think does. So this is a connectivity matrix. What we've done is we listed down here, it's too small for you to see on this slide, but it doesn't really matter what the specific regions are. These are 76 brain regions, 38 bilateral pairs. And we listed the same list down here and across here. And in the case where a significant correlation exists in the fMRI time series between the two regions, we place a colored square. If no significant correlation exists, we place a gray square. So you tell me, what do you notice about the normal individuals and the siblings in comparison to the autistic individuals?
Less colored squares.
Yeah, fewer colored squares, right. Okay, so it seems that this measure of long-range connectivity is what is differentiating the people with and without autism in these families. So they have a local frontal lobe property which links them, but then they are differentiated by perhaps whether or not, and Eric, you can tell more about this than I, because you study earlier ages, they seem to be differentiated by the question of whether or not that localized frontal abnormality has snowballed developmentally into a wide-ranging disruption of brain connectivity. Okay, so in the second part of the talk, how are you doing? Doing okay?
Not too bad, so.
Great.
Do you want me to tell you how long you go?
That would be lovely.
5 minutes.
Thank you. Okay. So, in the second, very, very quick part of the talk, I want to tell you how all of this may relate to therapy. Now, there's a right way and a wrong way to conduct autism therapy. Which way is this? Yeah, wrong way. How can we work with instead of against a person who has this cognitive style? Here's a picture of a child with autism, a small child with autism, and you can imagine what's going on in the picture. You know, people may be complaining, oh, look, you know, he's not even playing with the toys, he's not looking at the camera, he's not looking at us, what is he doing? Well, the question is, what is he doing? He's fiddling the string. And he actually has noticed a very important input-output relationship about this string. He noticed that there's a parametric relationship between the amount of torque that he gives to the string by twisting his wrist and the amount of deflection that he can see in the string resulting from that torque. So this child is behaving like a scientist. And this is key, right? No teacher has told him to do this. Wow! So how can we harness that? How can we make use of this fascination with sensory motor contingencies? Narrow attention to specific stimuli is not always a deleterious trait. Sometimes in some behavioral contexts, it can be exactly what you want. So how can we do a little bit of perspective taking ourselves and get into the world of fascinations of the autistic child and make that a vehicle for education? Well, I think doing that depends fundamentally on recognizing that there is a problem of simultaneity in autistic cognition. If you have a long-range disconnected brain, then it's okay, I'll post the slides. You can just Google me and review me. If you have a long-range disconnected brain, then having two processes simultaneously with access to the central executive becomes a very, very difficult proposition. So simultaneously knowing that something is true and imagining that something else, counterfactual, might be true. Simultaneously representing oneself and one's own perspective and another person and their perspective. Simultaneously thinking a thought and trying to phrase it and put it into words. That's really difficult, so sometimes you just come out with a hallelujah. Simultaneously perceiving something and conceiving something. That's also really difficult. So when you're trying to think, sometimes you just avert your gaze. Simultaneously seeing and hearing. Also really difficult, so you tend to become a specialist in one sensory modality. Well, how do autistic communication methods work? A lot of them work by slowing down communication, reducing the demand for rapid integration or synchrony, just so that it becomes unnecessary to focus on the thought and the communicative act simultaneously. So we studied one of these methods, it's called the rapid prompting method. It was developed by Shoma Mukhopadhyay. A lot of you probably know him for some Tico, who is a famous autistic poet. and writer. And this actually is based on some fundamental strategies developed by Prathi Gautam at the Communication Deal Center in Bangalore, not to be confused with one of a similar name in Australia, that we developed about 10 years back, and we actually have been working with Prathi Gautam on this. We looked at the rapid prompting method. This is work by my former undergraduates, Bruce and Keith Yoder. We found that exposure to the therapy actually decreases repetitive behaviors, despite the fact that repetitive behaviors are not explicitly targeted. It increases the ability to make multiple choice selections amongst larger and larger sets of multiple choice items. The kind of sensory prompting and sensory reorienting of attention that the therapist does is crucial to increasing the response rate. And perhaps most interestingly, direct eye gaze in many, though not all, individuals actually sabotages communicative capacity. Because again, perceiving and conceiving simultaneously is a difficult proposition. So in my last minute, I want to cover something a little bit different, something about the cultural contrast that we've been doing. Okay, how many people mostly saw the S? And how many people mostly saw the N? Yeah, okay. So if I ask that question in India, well, where I've been working, the ratio of people who saw the S and the N would be a little different. And that highlights something that is, I think, a source of convergent human cognitive variation that we're getting to here. There is a mode of brain function where a brain operates as a collection of autonomous subprocessors, and there is a mode of brain function where a brain operates as a top-down, commanded, and coordinated unit. And we are all, in different individuals and in different behavioral contexts, somewhere on this axis between single-channel and multi-channel perception, between detailed and contextual representations, between iconic and symbolic referencing, and between egocentric and allocentric perspectives. At one extreme, you have people with autism. At the other, you have non-autistic people. At one extreme, you have social psychologist Jacob Troppe refers to as low construal, which is exactly the same concept that Fritz and Hape term central coherence. It's just that social psychologists and autism psychologists read each other's papers a lot. You have Simon Baron-Cohen's work on cognitive sex differences, where one end of the spectrum is more typical of the male population at a population level, and the other more typical of the female population. And finally, you have Nisbet's work on cross-cultural contrasts that indicates that one end of the spectrum is more typical of Western cognition, and one end of the spectrum is more typical of Asian and South Asian cognition. So this is something that we are, these cultural contrasts and other elements of this axis is something that we're working on right now, which I don't have time to tell you about, but it's an interesting proposition as to how cultural elements interact with the autism phenotype and with the manifestation of the autism phenotype, particularly the mild end of the autism spectrum. We're working on that in Kolkata right now. Lastly, let me say, this link between cognitive diversity and the pathology of autism gives us a caution. When we say we want to cure autism, what we really want to do is give people with autism the communicative abilities to share their insights with the rest of the social world. We don't want to risk deleting those insights, because sometimes an iconic and egocentric and detail-oriented style of thinking, again, is exactly what we want, and it's very productive. It's just a question of communicating that perspective. All of this work is from a large number of collaborators that I have both in India and in the U.S., people at National Brain Research Center, Vishwarajan's group at Manohar Gajkendra in Kolkata, my old group at Cornell, and more of my old group at Cornell, and our funders, U.S. National Science Foundation, Autism Speaks, and our collaboration with Google, and also
Yeah, I can't. How robust is your graph entropy if you take into account the fact that the graph could be in fact a two-dimensional or three-dimensional network, or if the graph has almost a smutty scale substructure, some kind of fractal structure? How stable is the theory? How robust is it?
I hope I'm understanding your question correctly. Keep the mic for a sec. You're asking whether the connectivity graph has...
Yes, for instance, there is a method in solid state physics where we call decimation, where we group, for instance, the states of subcells and so on, and we can define entropy at the different level of scales. And that creates sometimes a very different picture, whether you stay at the very elementary scale or whether you go to some superstructure.
Okay, yes. So the issue of scaling in representations of brain connectivity is a huge one. It goes up from the level of individual neurons and small neural networks up to whole brain connectivity structure. I and my group have not looked at that, but we do have data that are ripe for other people to analyze. So I would welcome that.
Okay, great. Well, I'm afraid we haven't got time for any more questions. Thanks, Dr. Matthew. And Roberto, over to you. And whilst Roberto is setting up